Hello, welcome to The Wire, Community and Indigenous Radio's national independent current affairs program. I'm Sarah Martin in Adelaide. Today, Australia to withdraw troops from Afghanistan after 20 years of continued presence in the country. Samoans await a result in their first contested election in nearly four decades. Campaigners are calling to raise the age of criminal responsibility from 12 to 14. And Indigenous youth encouraged to get counted in the census. Stay with us for the next half hour. First joining me in the studio is Annie Haswell. Hi, Annie.
Hi, Sarah. Looking across the world as we do at this time on the COVID statistics, worldwide there's 138 million cases, recovered 78.5 million of those and 2.97 deaths. In Australia, 29,451 cases, 25,500, I guess you would say, have recovered and 909 deaths.
India's COVID caseload has risen sharply in the past few weeks.
Yes, the country's been reporting more than 150,000 cases a day. And if you compare that to January and February this year, their daily cases had fallen below 20,000 then.
What's the reason?
Well, they've reopened workplaces, markets and malls. And anyone who's been to India knows how many people there are on the streets at any given time. Transport's operating at full capacity. Big weddings, festivals and election rallies are also being held. So the result is a situation that one doctor described as a COVID tsunami.
And in Australia, yesterday's announcement of mass vaccination clinics isn't impressing some doctors.
No, experts and doctors have warned that the new clinics will do little to aid Australia's flawed vaccine rollout without greater supply certainty, and they might even undermine the efforts of GPs. They say the problem right now isn't distribution, it's supply. The federal government has signalled it wants to work with states and territories to set up those vaccination clinics as part of a broader effort to overhaul the rollout strategy.
In the US, Minnesota has been on a knife edge after the shooting of a black motorist, and there's been some developments there.
Yes, a white former police officer, former because she's just been forced to resign, shot dead a black motorist in Minnesota earlier this week. And there's been rallies outside the police station in Brooklyn Center for all of this week, as they waited to see what the result would be. That police officer, Kim Potter, has now been arrested, charged with second-degree manslaughter and then released on a $100,000 bail. Police say that Mrs. Potter shot Daunte Wright accidentally, that she mistakenly drew her gun instead of her taser, which has resulted in a lot of cynicism and a lot of investigation of where policemen keep guns and where they keep their tasers.
And Torres Strait Islanders are taking their climate concerns to the UN.
Yes, a group of Indigenous Islanders from the Torres Strait have launched a world-first legal battle in a bid to protect their homes from sea inundation. They argue that Australia has breached their rights to culture and life by failing to adequately address climate change. These islanders have watched rising sea levels, coastal erosion and flooding in recent years. And it's the first time a claim of this kind has been taken to the UN Human Rights Committee.
And good news on the march towards electric vehicles.
Yes, the home of the car, the US, will have all new cars and trucks powered by electricity by 2035. That's according to a new University of California study. The upfront cost of electric cars is set to reach parity with gasoline vehicles in around 5 years' time. Electric vehicles currently make up only 2% of all cars sold in the US, and the reason for that is the cost, because they're a lot more expensive as they are here, as well as concerns about the availability of recharge points. But the Biden administration is on the job, and they've also outlined plans to electrify buses, and data centres and aeroplanes may also start to rely upon batteries in a shift to cleaner energy.
Still in the US, President Biden has announced the country will withdraw its troops from Afghanistan by 11th of September after two decades of a patently unsuccessful war.
Yes, many Afghans now fear a terrible tumbling towards civil war in the conflict that's already described as one of the most violent in the world. Bad news for women in Afghanistan, amongst other dire predictions, and Australia too will be pulling out.
And you spoke to Middle East expert John Bruni about this a short while ago.
Yes, I asked John why the US is leaving.
If you're in a situation, Annie, that you've invested a lot of time, you know, blood, treasure, and manpower in trying to get something achieved, something that's decisive, something good for a nation, and you, after, you know, like a couple of decades, haven't kicked the goals that you were expecting, I suppose the question is, why are you staying and what is the main mission? Now, of course, the main mission was to get rid of Al-Qaeda and to dethrone the Taliban, which, of course, the Americans achieved as a military strike from October to December of 2001. But since then, it's just been an ongoing mission creep whereby the Americans kept on having these ambitious targets and goals that they set for themselves, trying to force the Afghan body politic into its way of thinking, and it's failed dismally. I mean, the Taliban, for instance, they want to have power in Kabul, and when the Americans are out, there will be nothing preventing them from actually achieving that end.
So we're really just giving the country back to the Taliban.
Well, I think that you will see that that will be the case. There is no stopping an ethnic-based political slash terrorist slash populist group from achieving their ends, because that is what they've been fighting for. They've been singularly focused on recapturing power in Afghanistan for all this time. They've seen America as the great interloper. And, you know, a lot of their propaganda has seeped out into the other tribal areas as well. And if you're an Afghan, it doesn't matter where on the tribal spectrum you stand, you still see the Americans predominantly as foreign interlopers. It's ironic in many ways because, you know, they don't have the same kind of antipathy toward, you know, the Indians, the Pakistanis, the Iranians or the Russians, but the Americans are the foreign interloper, right?
What about Australia? Because Prime Minister Scott Morrison has announced that we will follow suit and pull out of Afghanistan by the deadline in September. How do the Afghans regard Australians, or are we too small to matter?
Well, I mean, we are one of the smaller contributors to the exercise. We'd like to think that we matter because we're very important to the United States. You know, the sooner that we can withdraw our forces from a sinking ship, the better. And Afghanistan, in many ways, is like the geopolitical version of the Titanic. You know, yes, we built this, you know, nation-building thing. We don't really know what that was meant to have achieved, but we spent many billions of dollars in trying to achieve it, only for it to have failed, you know, catastrophically by hitting the iceberg of the reality. And the reality is the Taliban have not been defeated, and the Taliban, once the Americans withdraw, are likely to resume power in Afghanistan at some point in the near future once the Americans have withdrawn.
Which means a return to fundamentalism and certainly pretty bad news for women.
You know, if anyone has a progressive agenda in Afghanistan, they'll be the first people lined up against the wall, unfortunately.
So we're leaving a country to possibly descend into some kind of chaos or, you know, pretty disastrous situation for a lot of people there. What about the wider geopolitical effects that this might have? Is it going to affect the balance of power amongst the surrounding countries at all?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the one thing that you can honestly say is that there's a clock running in the corridors of power in Russia, in China, in Pakistan, in India, and in Iran. Each of these neighboring states of Afghanistan have huge interest in seeing the Americans leave so that they can start setting up shop to try to extract some critical minerals that are vital for a greener future. And of course, you know, we're talking about things like lithium, we're talking about rare earths. You know, Afghanistan can be a very rich country. The problem that's always let Afghanistan down is its tribal factionalism and then, of course, their incapacity to share national resources because it's all based on tribes and ethnicity. So it requires the strong arm of a major power to come in and try to set up those extractive industries.
Director of Sage International and Middle East expert John Bruni, speaking there with The Wire's Annie Haswell. Wherever you are on Indigenous and Community Radio, my name's Sarah Martin and you're with The Wire. On the 30th anniversary of the Royal Commission into Indigenous Deaths in Custody, conversations about the minimum age of criminal responsibility are being raised by community leaders around Australia. Different states have opposing viewpoints on the issue. Declan Hoare attended a rally in Adelaide today.
It should be way older. I mean, it should be raised to 18. These are kids. They shouldn't be criminalised at all.
Different states have very different ideas about what the minimum age of criminal responsibility should be. Today I went down to a rally in Adelaide. This state is arguing for the age to be raised from 10 to 14. Local Narangeri elder Uncle Mugi Sumner was one of the speakers.
Today, we can talk about it again. Talk about deaths in custody. Talk about Aboriginal people. Across this land, young and old, male and female, dying.
Local Greens MLC Robert Sims says that he believes the age must be raised and he will be pursuing a bill in Parliament to make the change.
I don't think anybody in our state would believe that children belong in prison. It's not the right way to treat kids. Children need loving and supportive environments. And we know, of course, that the way that this law operates in practice is that it disproportionately impacts on Indigenous children.
Why is that such a large proportion of children that are affected by this legislation?
What we know in Australia and rates of incarceration in general is that Aboriginal people are much more likely to face incarceration. And I think there's systemic racism has been a long part of our justice system in Australia, and that needs to change. And so we need to look at laws like this that perpetuate that cycle. I'll be moving to ensure that this bill is put back on the notice paper and that we continue to advocate for the law to change here in South Australia.
Do you think that raising this minimum age is enough, or is that just a first step?
It's certainly not enough on its own, and there's so much work that has to happen at a national level, at a state level. We need to see the recommendations of the Royal Commission implemented here in South Australia. There's a whole range of things that need to happen. But this is a small element of that. I know that the state government have said, well, they're waiting for a federal government response, but I don't think that's good enough. And I think we can do better than that.
During the rally, we heard Uncle Mugi talk about a sort of corrections facility that can help those incarcerated get back on their feet and not be reintroduced into the prison system once they're released. Is that something that you think should be pursued in South Australia?
Well, I think we need to look at our whole justice system. What we don't want to see is, through incarceration, people coming out and being more likely to offend in the future, or being part of a cycle. And, you know, we know that that's often what happens when people are incarcerated, particularly young people. And so I think we need to look very differently at our justice system around how we ensure that we do rehabilitate people, but also ensure that people are only ever being detained and locked up as a last resort.
Do you think that there is room for some police reform in all of this?
Yeah, absolutely. And there needs to be anti-racism work done with police. And I know my colleague Tammy Franks has been doing a lot of work in terms of pushing for that. There needs to be cultural change happening through SAPOL. We need to look at laws like this that perpetuate structural inequality and impact disproportionately on some people within our community.
Is it right that our kids are getting locked up at 10? Would you let your 10-year-old kids get locked up over stealing a grape from a fruit shop? Would you let them get locked up over a can of Coke? It's ridiculous what our kids get put through, what our women and our men get put through, and it needs to change.
Natasha from SOS Black, ending that report by The Wire's Declan Hoare.
After a hard day out in the paddock, I like to catch up with The Wire. Find out what's going on around this big country.
The Wire, bringing you the stories from all around Australia.
For the first time in nearly 40 years, the Pacific island country of Samoa is facing a political shake-up. Last Friday, the country went to the polls, and preliminary counting has the incumbent HRPP party and opposition Fast Party, led by the former Deputy Prime Minister, tied at 25 seats each. Sapir Mayron is a journalist at the Samoa Observer. I asked her how Samoans have reacted.
I think people expected that we'd see a change at the election, that we would see something happen, certainly for the ruling party to maybe not lose their majority, but lose their totality over government. But to have had a situation we're in now with 25 seats each between the two parties, I think people weren't expecting it. It's come at quite a shock to those, both who voted for one or the other. So it's got people quite excited and apprehensive, I suppose. Lots of anticipation about the next couple of weeks.
Tell me a bit about the parties. The Human Rights Protection Party is the incumbent, and they've been in control for decades.
HRPP is one of Samoa's earliest parties. Soon after independence, there was no party system, and HRPP formed in a growing party system. But it's still taken a long time to have a fully fledged party system, and in the meantime, HRPP has basically run a one-party state. And its current leader, Suila Epa Sailele Malielinga Oi, has been the Prime Minister for the last 23 years or so.
And in contrast, the opposition FAST Party, they've only existed for 6 months. That seems pretty phenomenal that they could have such an influence in such a short time.
It is pretty phenomenal. And I think that's how they see it too, that they're experiencing themselves within a phenomena. It's only natural that after 40 years, the population might feel a little bit irksome with its leaders. I mean, those who are frustrated get more frustrated the less things change. People are wanting, you know, something big to happen. And that's exactly what has happened. And I think also FAST have been very savvy. They've known where they need to go to talk to the people that need to be talked to, and that includes the rural areas of Samoa that typically don't get a hearing from those in power and those outside Samoa who for the last 5 or so years have been somewhat denigrated by those in power.
What party platforms do both the HRPP and FAST hold?
I think they're both learning how to have a party platform, because for a long time people were elected on the basis of what they would do for a constituency. You know, how are they going to grow the development of that area? Are they going to improve the roading, access to markets for farmers, opportunities to finance for small businesses, that kind of growing the economy sort of stuff? But recently there's been a lot of pressure and controversy over the constitution, over the courts, over the judiciary, over land, over the law itself, how people are punished or not. So the two parties have developed quite distinct platforms in this area. FAST have said, we will do all it takes to protect land and protect people and protect business, whereas HRPP has used their last 40 years to say, we've been doing a good thing here and we're going to keep the stability, we're going to keep improving on what we've already got. You should trust our record on that.
The election's sitting pretty much 50-50, and the balance of power is essentially in the hands of a single independent candidate, Tuala Yosefo Ponifasio, who's waiting on the official result before he makes a decision. Is there any indication about which way he may sway?
So Tuala, he's in an interesting situation because right now he holds the balance of power, but he's right to wait on the official results. We're still not only recounting the votes from Friday, but also adding special votes. So they're ones that were cast outside the constituency and need to be added to the constituency that they belong to. In some constituencies where the vote was quite tight, we may see a seat go to the other party, and then he may not hold the balance of power anymore. But previously, what we know about him is that he has been fighting with government over many things. Just last September, he spent a month and a half in court trying to challenge the electoral laws that nearly had him not qualified to even run as a candidate at all. And he managed to prove in the court that those laws were written quite poorly and had them changed. So that's been an interesting one that people, you know, obviously think about when they consider where he may go. But then again, he's also been trying for the last three elections to get into parliament. So depending on what is put on the table or maybe what isn't put on the table, that may affect the choice he makes as well.
Ultimately, it's going to be a very close majority, regardless of which way that goes and how this all falls. What does that mean for the Samoan public in terms of how the government will then serve them?
I think it means good things for the public. I may be a little biased, but I do love me a good democratic debate in Parliament. And I think the Samoan public, who typically does tune in when Parliament is sitting and they do listen on the radio as the debates are broadcast live, they're going to get a very different experience of what it means to propose and pass legislation, where previously they might have read out the bill and had a couple things to say about it. Maybe somebody would point out a flaw here or make a comment there. We're going to watch as the two parties actually go back and forth quite heatedly over proposed changes, because there'll be a genuine opposition that will purposefully, I think, find things to debate about. And so I think it's going to change how the population sees Parliament, sees their members in the House and what they're supposed to be doing for them, which, in my personal opinion, can only be a good thing.
Sapir Mehron, journalist at the Samoa Observer. Every 5 years, the Australian people complete the census, a survey which records data about who we are and tells the story of how we are changing as a country. But Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples have been undercounted in previous census surveys. And with this year's survey approaching, there's a push for more participation from these communities, especially the youth. Hayley Allen is a proud Gamilaroi woman and ABS Census Communication Officer. She spoke with The Wire's Michelle Stevenson about why inclusion in the census is so important.
Inclusion in the census for not only Indigenous Australians but all Australians is really important. The census helps inform a snapshot of who we are and how we're changing. It's used to make decisions about housing, schools, early learning centres, health clinics, jobs and roads. The census really helps tell a story of our communities over time, and it shows our community's strengths and where we need to help continue to grow.
Why have Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in Australia been undercounted historically?
In 2016, we had an undercount of 17.5 for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And so I'm a Gamilaroi woman, and for 2021, we're trying to do something to reduce that to help not only my mob but all Indigenous communities around Australia. Sometimes Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are not counted because census information we get isn't fully completed. We really want to strengthen the importance of filling in everything on the census. And historically, sometimes we don't, Indigenous Australians and all Australians aren't including everyone staying at their home on census night. So it's really important that we include our elders, our babies, aunties and uncles, or someone coming over to stay. Anyone that's on our house on August 10, we need to include in the census.
What's the impact of being excluded?
The impact of being excluded means we won't have that vital data we need for roads, for jobs, for health clinics. We really need the data for the important decision-making for the next 5 years that really help and strengthen our communities.
So how exactly is the census information being used to benefit Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities?
The census is being used to benefit Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities by helping with different initiatives such as enabling programs for universities, having that strong data help universities with enabling programs. Also stuff like health clinics where we need more Indigenous health facilities, the census is able to help inform that.
What different ways are being used to reach out to Aboriginal communities and people this year?
Things are changing this year for the census. So early August, you'll receive an instruction letter with your temporary password and ID on there, and you're able to log online. You can do it online, on your phone. And for some of our elders and our aunties and uncles, we have interviewers that will come and fill in the census for you, and others that you can provide assistance from a pop-up hub. Community centres will have lots of different ways for you to help fill the census.
Do you think that young people especially understand the importance of the census?
Yeah, for many young Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander and young people, this will be the first time that they'll actually be completing the census. Like myself, it's the first time you've moved out of home or you've moved on to residence of college. So it's really important that we help educate our younger Australians on why isn't they filling in the census and why it's important.
Is language a barrier?
Sometimes language can be a barrier for not only young people but Indigenous Australians as well. And so that's why we have lots of different ways. We have easy to read census forms, which for low literacy, they help. We also have Braille forms. We have our interviewers that can come and help you fill in the census. We really want to help the community and stop those barriers from filling in the census.
You're employed by Census. Do you think this gives you a better appreciation for what it does? And could further employment of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people improve communication to communities?
I'm employed by the census, yes. I came in as an Indigenous graduate, and I think it gave me a really good understanding of, I actually didn't know that these things informed the census, or I didn't know that that's why I'm filling in the census. So I think if I can help with my knowledge of why these programs are important, it's really important to have young voices actually saying, well, you know what, the census is important because I'm going to want to further my study and it's going to help our Indigenous enabling programs.
Hayley Allen, proud Gamilaroi woman and ABC Census Communication Officer, speaking with The Wire's Michelle Stevenson. The census will be held on August 10. That's all for The Wire today. If you'd like to hear any of our stories again, head to our website, thewire.org.au. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is The Wire Radio. This program is a team effort by 2SER, Radio Adelaide and 4EB in Brisbane, and we are produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can hear us through your radio or on our podcast every weekday across Australia on the Community Radio Network. Today's show came from the studios of Radio Adelaide on Kaurna Lands. I'm Sarah Martin. Thanks for joining us.